What is up? We are back. Tony in the Field.
Tony in the Field. Oh, my God. I love those guys.
So excited to be on Tony in the Field. Love the show.
Oh, man. I can't wait. I'm fired. Preston, what's on the menu, brother?
The gloves are coming off.
James catches, puts up a three. Won't go. Rebound box. Back out to Allen. History final. Bang! Tie game with 5 seconds remaining.
Swoops. Dancing for the win! Texas is back, folks!
Indiana's 9 out of 12.
Oh! Gerald Green! That's a man's jam!
And we are joined now by Steve Mims, who spent 21 years at the Register Guard in Eugene, Oregon. A really great newspaper there that is now obviously a high-quality online publication as well. And Steve spent a lot of time at the RG, most notably recently covering Oregon athletics when I was there at KVAL. And if you're a U of O fan or a U of O alumni, I'm sure you've definitely read his work plenty of times, as I know both Big Tony and I have as well. Steve, thanks so much for coming on, man.
You got it, man. Great to catch up with you guys.
Totally. So I guess let's just start there. I mean, 21 years, that's a long time to be doing anything. And you're at the Guard for 21 years. I mean, first of all, just congrats on the move. That's one of the big reasons we're having you on the pod is you announced that you're transitioning to a financial services role outside of the media industry. And just first and foremost, congrats on the move.
Thanks. I appreciate it. It's been nice to make a little midlife challenge, and I'm enjoying it. It's been something I've been doing for about 6 months, but just kind of went public with about a month ago. So it's been good. I appreciate you guys letting me chat a little bit about it.
Totally. And you and I talked on the phone for like 30 minutes last week, just kind of catching up. And you were saying you'd been kind of considering doing this for a while and training, I guess, for the licensing side for a while now, correct?
Yeah, no, this was probably about a 18-month process total, just from kind of deciding, hey, I need a new career and kind of going back and kind of talking to a lot of people I really respected in the business world around here. And then last September was when I kind of pivoted the insurance world and started kind of going through the licensing process and got licensed in December. I actually started working at New York Life in April and just kind of jogged my way through two jobs for the last few months before August 31st was kind of the separation day from the Guard and onto the new world.
Steve, that's awesome. Especially juggling those two positions and then making the full-time transition into your new career. Like Chief said, congrats on that. Really happy for you. Would you mind if I asked what kind of led/went into this decision of not just a shift into your current position, but just a shift away from the sports media industry in general? What was it before the 18 months that you were thinking about it at any point, making a career shift into a new field, or was it exactly 18 months ago? How did that process go, and what exactly did it look like?
Yeah, it was probably, once the Register Guard sold 3 years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, March, I had kind of some immediate concerns that, hey, what's this going to look like once a locally owned paper goes corporate? And for a little while, it was okay, but it became pretty clear right away that, and it's not a Register Guard thing, it's just the newspaper industry as a whole, you know, with corporations taking over locally owned papers, it just kind of takes on a different way. And I became uncomfortable with the way we were doing it. You're kind of going for online clicks and you're kind of sacrificing the print product in my mind. And there's a lot fewer resources, you know, in the old days, if you felt like, hey, this is something we should invest in for a story, you could go upstairs and go talk to the boss. And now the boss is over in, other cities, and it would take two or three people to get to them. And I just felt like the industry as a whole was changing, and it wasn't kind of the way I liked it. I feel like I'd been there, you know, with guys like Ron Bellamy and Bob Clark and John Conrad and just some giants of local journalism in this town. And I saw how good this paper was. And just for me, it felt like with the corporate ownership, we weren't going to be that way again. And in fact, there was one boss who told me that directly, that, hey, I feel like you're kind of getting bitter because you want it to be the way it used to be, and I'm here to tell you it'll never be that way again. And to me, that's just not the business model I want to be part of, was, hey, we're never going to be as good as we used to be. To me, that was sort of a sign that it's probably a good time for me to make a move. So like I say, last summer, summer of 2019, I started talking to a lot of people, five or six people in town who I really respected, and just was like, hey, I'm at an age where I'm going to need to make a mid-career change, and what do you think? And it's kind of the one kind of feedback I kept getting from people was, hey, you've had your name in the paper in this town for 20 years. One thing you might want to do is just kind of try to build on that brand. You've built kind of a trusted brand, a brand in town that people know what you do and trust what you do, and try to carry it over to that. And so after looking around a little bit, the insurance was the way I decided to go. And like I say, kind of last August, September was when I really honed in on that.
And we appreciate your honesty and transparency. We're super passionate about the sports media game and just kind of the evolution of it. And we're fascinated by it. I felt some of the same corporate restrictions, if you will, during my time at KVAL, to be completely honest. Obviously you were in the game at that level for a lot longer. So I'd love to hear your opinion just on, in general, and it doesn't have to be like a cynical take, but just like in general, how the industry has changed over the years, either locally and in your experience, or just in general, how do you feel like the sports media industry has changed since you were first in the game in the 90s to where it is now? I mean, every industry changes, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, but how have you seen, you know, the media game change?
Boy, there's been a lot of it. I mean, you go back, I mean, you've been looking at college athletics. I mean, if you go back to when I started, the people who were covering the Ducks, it was, you know, you can show up in practice, you can watch practice, and then, you know, practice is over. You tell the SIA, here's the three people I want to talk to, and they bring them over there. And, you know, that kind of shifted at Oregon, at least in the Chip Kelly era, when it became like, oh, well, now let's do 24-hour advance notice so that if something happens to somebody at practice, you know, you can't do that then. And now it's sort of become a deal. You still get a lot of one-on-one interviews, and now it's, you know, everything is sort of set up. Hey, let's do a group interview, and you end up with, you know, seven cameras and, you know, 14 reporters out there for a Justin Herbert interview. And, you know, a couple people have their own kind of agenda, what they're trying to look for, and it becomes really impossible, I think, a lot of times to write anything original. I would get frustrated. I'd, you know, be sitting there doing a one-on-one with somebody, and I thought was a one-on-one, and I'm talking to somebody, and then, you know, I walk away, and then I get back to the office getting ready to write, and you realize that there was some blogger who was behind you with a video camera, was basically just taping your interview and then uploading it to Twitter as soon as they could. And I get back, and I was like, man, all the stuff I thought was original has already been put out there. So that's a big part of it, is just, you know, kind of the world of kind of getting kind of more one-on-one, and schools that want to work with you. I mean, a lot of schools now have, they want to kind of put their message out. They want to have their messenger who sends it. And that's, you know, that's in a lot of places that are doing that. And that's just sort of the way this thing's gone. And so that's been, you know, disappointing, that I just think that a lot of times the local media isn't given kind of the, you know, the ability to tell the stories that maybe they used to. And quite frankly now, you know, with some of the ways that the local media is moving, maybe they don't deserve it as well either. I mean, they're not doing kind of the job that they used to be able to do as well. But it feels like a lot of times if, you know, if ESPN or Fox shows up, there's no problem for them getting a one-on-one or, you know, interviews like this and that. Whereas, you know, even some of the, you know, the Athletic or, you know, some of the local people who are national have a hard time getting any sort of exclusive access for content. And so it's just become, in that sense, certainly a lot more difficult to be able to tell stories and tell original stories rather than just having to be in a scrum. And then you get out and, you know, you could ask two or three really good questions and feel like I got a good story out of that. And then by the time, like I say, you get back, somebody else has already written it because you got people in there who maybe didn't even ask a question, but they've got all the same answers as you.
That's really well said, Steve. And that is a great summary of some of, you know, the ways that the local game has changed, and a lot of issues that you, I'm sure, have run into, as we all have over the years covering at the local level. I want to ask you about the national shift for the sports media landscape, and really specifically one topic. Just over the years, it seems like there's more and more of hot take shows and content of that nature, and the volume is just, it's gotten to the point where it, in my opinion, and Preston and I talk about this all the time, it's really sort of diluting the rest of the content and the positions and roles that we're seeing in sports media. So in your eyes, I'd love to get your take on this. Do you see the future of, or first of all, your thoughts on just the sheer volume of that kind of content in the industry? And then a follow-up, do you see the future of the sports media landscape having more or less of that kind of hot take, immediate, like overreaction content in the future?
Yeah, absolutely more. You know, I think, I really enjoyed Colin Coward. I remember hearing him back in Portland, and I think he's really good at what he does, but Colin's not going to talk about anything that's, you know, in the NBA that's not the Lakers or Giannis, or, you know, he's not going to discuss, you know, what some small market team's going to do. He's not going to touch on any baseball unless it's Dodgers or Yankees. He's not going to talk, you know, any college football unless it's Alabama, you know, in the top ones. Same thing with foot, and he's going to lead everything with football because he knows this time of year. And it's smart for him. You know, he knows kind of what the content is, but there's no, you know, I appreciate kind of shows to where you can get into kind of some of the details of some smaller things. But, you know, I think Coward's kind of led a way that I'm sure works for him. And I'm sure that they have all the analytics that, hey, if you're talking about these, you know, the Dallas Cowboys are going to be on every Colin Coward show during this time of year. It doesn't matter which segment it is. At some point during those 3 hours, there's going to be a Dak Prescott conversation because they know that that's what gets people going. Same thing with First Take and, you know, the Undisputed and things like that. So the national ones like that, absolutely. I also look at people like, you know, Jason Whitlock made news this week because he took a shot at Maria Taylor, and the blowback was all very negative. Jason Whitlock knew going into that the blowback was going to be negative. He also knew that he was going to get a ton of attention for it, and that's kind of what happened there. I think Doug Gottlieb's done a lot of that too, to where a guy who he knows that, you know, he went on, I think when Andrew Luck retired, and said, you know, oh, a typical millennial wasn't tough enough to kind of stick it out. Again, people, you know, the reaction on Twitter is so overly negative towards those things, and people act like, wow, he's getting killed. But it's like, I guarantee you, the moment he tweeted that, he knew that it was going to be 90% negative, but he also knew that he was going to get 5, 6, 7 times as many reactions to it as he would, and he'd get his name out there more. And that's, I think, a big part of what people are doing these days is they want to get their name out there. And if they can say something controversial, if they can say something that, you know, is going to kind of get people talking, they don't care. You know, it's the old, you know, we don't care if it's negative or positive. We just want attention. And there's a ton of that right now in this business, especially as some people try to get going. You know, you see a lot of people on Fox, I think, you know, the Nick Wrights and people like that, who just want to say something because they hope that whatever they said gets suddenly on Twitter, and whether people are reacting positively or negatively, suddenly their followers grow. And people, I'm stunned when people, you know, Skip Bayless says something about somebody and people go on to, you know, local people go on to Twitter and react to it. It's like, all you're doing is feeding that beast there. And that's absolutely what he wants to do. He wants to, you know, when he goes on, and what was it? It was the Dak Prescott mental health thing. When he goes on and criticizes him for mental health, all he wants is to make sure that people in Eugene, Oregon, Portland, Oregon, places way outside his normal boundaries, are retweeting it and pointing it out. And if it's 90% negative, it's not going to bother him because he knows that he's just grown his audience, because somebody who has 7,000 followers has just brought Skip into there and brought him into more. So I think people don't realize that a lot of those national people, they're doing this to try to get local folks to bring them into their audience, into their followers, and know exactly what they're doing.
And that's a great point about bringing in different local demographics to a national show based on what the analytics tell them. That's why Big Tony and I have said for a while that it's certainly the fault of the host, but it's also the fault of the executive who's telling him or her to do that, if that is the case. They're encouraging that because of what the analytics tell them as far as ratings go. So that's a great point. Let's have some fun here. And we certainly appreciate your vast knowledge of industry talk that you just gave us there. But let's have some fun and reflect back on your career at the Guard, because I know you and I were in countless media scrums together when I was there for 3 years, whether it was covering football or basketball or another sport. We had some great colleagues there. I mean, folks who are outside the media, all media members are colleagues, especially when you're covering the same team. Like, those are your coworkers. Like, doesn't matter if you're at a KVAL station or a KZI or a KMTR, or you're a writer for the Guard, writer for the Oregonian, writer for whomever. You're all colleagues there. One of your great colleagues, Tyson Alger, I don't have the tweet in front of me, but he said something about you hold a record for the number of press box hot dogs eaten in one night. I want to say, were you a big press box hot dog guy?
I think that might have been more of the baseball, because Oregon baseball used to have, in fact, it was funny, they used to have like those little, you know, those little hot dog machines where it like rolls. It's like if you're in the 7-Eleven and they kind of spin them around there. And Miles right. and the people used to have kind of complimentary ones in there. So you're there for like a 4-hour baseball game. And if you remember those old George Horton games, they tend to drag on a little bit. And so, yeah, there might have been 3 or 4 of those that would be had. And, and you know, because again, it was like that or popcorn. But the thing I laughed about is they had like some budget cuts at Oregon. And then suddenly, like the next year, they cut out the hot dog machine. And that was like the first time in 4 years that Horton's team didn't make the postseason. So I told them, I said, you know, it's pretty clear at this point that you guys have jinxed everything by taking out the hot dog machine, but they never did bring it back. But yeah, some of those Sunday games, you know, you wake up and, you know, you don't have a breakfast and you get to that noon game and, you know, it ends up being, you know, on, you know, a Sunday college baseball is, it starts with your number 3 guy and then your 6 relievers in and it's about 4:30 before you're getting to the end. So there might have been 4 or 5 hot dogs put away in a couple of those games at least, but these aren't footlong Dodger dogs. These are, you know, your typical Oscar Mayer ones.
Right. I can speak to that. Those, they were smaller hot dogs, like pretty dang small.
Absolutely. Tyson but, clearly did not address that in the tweet, but that's okay.
Right. But 5's a 5's a good number. I like that. Yeah. Big Tony.
Yeah. 1 an hour every once in a while. That I did tell my wife this summer. I said, you know, with no Eugene Emeralds to cover, I said, I probably, you know, in a normal summer, I would have probably put on about 15 more pounds because you're just eating hot dogs and hamburgers and, you know, 2 sodas every night. I said the fact that I wasn't given complimentary hot dogs and hamburgers and sodas this summer probably saved me about 15 pounds.
Oh, that's hysterical. Yeah, I remember those hot dogs too. Not the best things in the world, but when you're hungry and that's all that you have, you best believe that you're scarfing a few of those down at the 7th.
And when they're free, you know, when you're hungry, they're free and it's all that's available. It's kind of a deadly combination.
That's sports media in a nutshell right there. Press box food. And speaking of, Steve, we've got written down here too another great question for you. Favorite press box food and least favorite press box food during your time in the industry?
The least favorite one's easy. It was funny. And if people know AJ Jacobson from Duck Sports Authority, we went to, I think it was like 3 years ago, there was an Oregon at Utah game and a football game. And we showed up there and the press box meal was like a soup and they had like cups and it was like the tiniest, but it was almost like, you know, little Dixie cups or something like that. And so AJ and I like, wow, that's kind of what they have. And then we went up there and it said one time through only. So you got like a little kind of one time through only little Dixie cup of soup from the Utah Utes. And that was, I think that was actually the year, that might even been that 2014 Helfrich year when they had the Kalen Clay fumbled the ball that year. Mm. So that would have been the worst ever, would have been the Dixie cups of soup there.
Come on, Utes.
What's that?
I just say, come on, you, it's a Dixie cup of soup. I mean, media members plan to have dinner at a football game sometimes. Come on, man.
And no second time through. And so you couldn't even go up there and just kind of get a second or third one. So that would have definitely been the worst one. The best one, man, I'm trying to think. You know, some of those Oregon ones are pretty good. I mean, Oregon will have some ones there where you got kind of some, you know, barbecue beef and a little bit of, you know, some potato salad with that and then kind of some bread on the side, some. So I'd say, you know, I'm probably biased towards Oregon because when you go there 7 times a year, even if you just one good one, that might, you might hit Washington or Washington State on a hot dog night or a Washington. It always seemed like it would be like a cold Chinese food type deal that would be in there. But I'm thinking it would have to be an Oregon one just because the number of times you went in there. I was always very disappointed with Oregon basketball. They never had any media food there. You know, if you got lucky, if they had a couple extra Papa's pizzas afterwards, they'd bring them out. But you never get anything pregame there. Actually, USC basketball was one of the better ones. You go down there and they'd have a whole spread, which not a lot of basketball ones do. They'd have a pretty good spread down there. UCLA basketball would always have like Jimmy John's or kind of some to where you could go in there. You know, they'd cut them into like, you know, 1/4 of a foot long, but if you got in there at the right time, you grab about 4 of them and take them up, and then you had your foot long.
There you go, dude. See, you're a savvy media eater. I can tell.
Well,
already.
You learn through the years. You know kind of what they got, so you know, like, all right, well, I'm going here. They're not going to have anything, or I'm going here, and it's not going to be very good. So you knew if you had to eat before or had to eat after, if you'd be all taken care of there, definitely. Yeah. After 7 years on the college beat, I knew what everybody was going to offer.
So you're on the football beat, but also the basketball beat, in addition to the baseball and then the Emeralds too. You know, I remember a lot of your work from the Oregon basketball beat. You were always the guy kind of leading off the post-game questions with Dana. And I got to ask you about, this just kind of came to my mind, but just your approach in general of asking questions, I thought was really unique and really good. It was like, you didn't even really ask a question. You just kind of made a statement and let the coach go off of that. And pretty much no one else in the media did that. And I was always kind of wondering how you pulled that off, because usually you have to have, like, I don't know, some street cred with the coach or something to just like ask not ask a question, just kind of make a statement and then have the coach give you a good answer. But you would also get good answers from the coach. So I guess to take our listeners into how you would approach a post game discussion with Coach Altman, and you always seem to be the guy leading off the questionnaires and the pressers with just kind of a statement about the game and how you kind of approached that setting.
Well, two things. The first one was Jason Quick, who was one of my best friends and was a great reporter for the Oregonian and now at the Athletic. He used to tell me the best question you can ask a coach post game is, why did you win? Why did you lose? It's like, it may catch them off guard, or they may like mock you that it was a simple question, but eventually you're going to get the answer you want. He said, sometimes the simplest question, the best. Like, I like to ask coach, why did you guys win tonight? And then, you know, he'll go on, or why did you lose? Altman's interesting because Dana normally walks in and you could ask him his first question. He always has it kind of in his mind. He's always looking at a box score and he always kind of knows what he's going to say. So if you pop in with, and I learned this afterwards because I'd see people who hadn't been experienced with him who would ask a first question like, hey, last play of the first half, why did you guys do this? And Dana would look at the box score and be like, you know, second chance points, free throw shooting, turnovers, those are the kind of things that cost us here. And then he just sort of has in his mind kind of an opening statement. I always felt like Oregon should have just let Dana do an opening statement rather than taking a first question, because he always kind of had it in his mind anyway. But I learned with Dana, it was sort of like the why'd you win, why'd you lose. I'd try to kind of come in with, you know, a more generic, just, hey, what'd you see? Because I knew that first thing was going to be him running through the box score. And then once you can kind of get him through that, then you can get him to get pretty in detail into some moments and things like that. But if you walk in the first question with Dana Altman and you say to him, you know, let's run through that last out of bounds play or something like that, I'm telling you, anybody who's covered him knows his first response to any question is going over, you know, points in the paint, points off turnovers, turnovers versus assists. He just runs through the same thing all the time. So you got to kind of open him up to that. And then once you can get that out of the way, then you can kind of get into some more detailed stuff.
All right. So I might be breaking a cardinal rule here, but I got three part questions, three in one. So we're talking about coaches, Steve, and you mentioned Altman. Give me your best Altman, Horton, and Chip Kelly quotes from all the times that you covered those three coaches.
Well, Chip, I didn't cover. I came into Helfrich, so I do Helfrich. I started on the Oregon beat in 14 or in yeah, 13 when Helfrich took over. So 14.
Gotcha.
So best all time quotes, though, Dan Altman would be a hard time to, you know, his best were when he'd kind of at some point mock himself. You know, somebody, he would do something where somebody would ask him about recruits or something, or you know, some like young players, and he'd, you know, we always used to joke. Dana would one of Dana's things is always like, you know, people are like, well, you know, what'd you say to those guys, you know, on the road, this and that? And he would always say, you know, well, those guys in their phones, you know, they're always on their phones. You're trying to convince them, you know, to think this way or that way. And those guys are always on their phones. And I remember I had a coworker, Chris Hansen, who was always like, what's that quote mean? He's like, everybody's always on their phones. He acts like these like 18 and 19 year olds are like the only guys who are always on their phones. He's like, but that was one, but he would, you know, when he was self deprecating, he'd be pretty funny. You know, I mean, he never aimed to be funny, but there were times where if you had him on there and you'd talk about like a big win or something, and he'd kind of say, you know, well, those guys, you know, you talk to them and talk to them and never think they get it. And, you know, wow, it suddenly came through. So when he would be self deprecating, he was pretty funny. Horton, you know, I mean, George, I, you know, I, George, I came in kind of right as they had a couple of runs, and then I was there for kind of the down part of it there as it kind of fell apart. But I'd say this about George Horton. George, you know, even in that last year as they were struggling, and George was the guy who always walked up to the scrum. He always stood there for every question. He always answered every question. You know, as it went on, you know, that's the guy who probably at Fulton never had anybody ask him anything negative because he had so much success, and this is the first time he had to deal with a little more of that. And I tell you, I felt like George Horton handled everything very well. He would call you by name, you know, even the person who just showed up, you know, in the media, he'd want to know who they were and talk to them, and he read the paper. And so I was appreciative. I just felt like George was always a guy who got it, you know, and he liked, you know, he wanted to be the one if they lost who stood there and addressed it. And if they won, who did, I just felt like he was very accountable on a lot of that. And Helfrich, I really liked Mark. I just felt like Mark Helfrich always kind of came in and felt like I'm just going to kind of keep doing what Chip does. I think Mark had a really good personality. I think he had kind of that Coos Bay small town sense of humor that really would have benefited him in this town. Unfortunately, I think when he came in, he thought, you know, Chip's done this and done this, and I'm going to kind of just kind of keep following the script of Chip. I think Mark's the guy who, if he'd have thought it over, would have probably had open practices, let fans in a little bit, let media in. I think that was more his personality. But when you follow a guy who'd been so successful like Chip, I think Mark felt like he had to kind of follow the game plan set out by Chip, because if he did something different and the results were different, people were going to say, hey, you're not doing it the same way. In the end, I think that backfired on him, that he was kind of, instead of doing it his way, he did it Chip's way. And then when it backfired, people got him for that. So, like I say, I think Mark was a guy who really could have owned this town, you know, I mean, particularly second year in a national title game. But I just think his person, I think he's the guy I've always said, I never felt like I got to know him really well. But I feel like if I were ever to run into him in a bar in Coos Bay, I think he'd be a great guy to hang out with for an hour. And I think we'd just laugh and tell stories. And I think that's sort of his personality. But I just think at the time he came in, he never really allowed himself to show that. And I think that was unfortunate. But, you know, he's done well. And I wish him the best. And I hope he gets another shot at something. But I think even if he looked back, he'd realize that maybe he should have been kind of his, done it the Helfrich way instead of trying to kind of recreate the Chip Kelly way.
Those are great points on all fronts about those coaches. Horton was one of my favorite coaches to speak with. Don't get me wrong, Oregon college baseball was not one of my favorite games to cover, but yeah. Horton was awesome to speak with. Even on like a Tuesday, you know, it'd be you, me, and one of the other local TV guys, and maybe one other writer, and Horton would just chill and shoot the breeze with us. And I remember I had to ask him, you know, kind of a straight to the point question one time of, you know, you're coming back for another year, what's your plan to turn the program around? And he was just, you know, super honest, looked straight into the camera and spoke for 4 minutes about it. And now he was Horton just treated everyone with the ultimate respect, which was really cool. It's a bummer that he couldn't get over the hump and get Oregon to the College World Series. I was a student at the time when they came one game away. I think they lost to like Kent State, I want to say.
On a little bloop single. And George was the guy. George has never, even if you asked him a difficult question, George never gave you a 10-second answer. Right. Your answers were, it was 2 to 3 minutes, because George wanted to, you know, he wanted to kind of explain what he was doing. You know, it's like a lot of coaches will snap or, you know, will kind of say, you know, or try to be really short with you. George really got it, that, hey, I've got a chance here. You know, if you're questioning what I'm doing, I'm going to explain what I'm doing so that you know it. And I always respected that. You know, I never saw him get, well, at the end there was, you know, maybe one or two. But, you know, for the most part, I never remember George being short with anybody, never disrespectful. If somebody asked a question that, you know, if there was a new person that was maybe scared and asking a question, George would look him in the eye and answer. And I just thought, and again, coming from a guy who had been at Fullerton and had really positive forever, you know, that would have been kind of guy that you would think, oh, he gets the Pac-12 and things don't go bad, he may not handle it well. But George always handled it well, and I've always appreciated that from him. Even afterwards, I, you know, called him, and he wanted to wait a couple months after it ended, but he came back in and wanted to do a chat about it, and he texted me after I made the career change. You know, he didn't need to do that, and I just think George Horton's a really quality. I'm with you. I wish he'd have had more success, because I hate the fact that people around here thinking, oh, George didn't kind of do what people thought he was going to do, this and that. I think what he did in starting the program, getting to the NCAAs in year two, what, year four, he's in a super regional, and if one ball falls the right way against Kent State, maybe they're in the College World Series and it's different. So, I hate kind of the when I talk to people around here, oh, George, you know, it was small ball and we didn't like this and that. And I don't think people realize, you know, just kind of what George did for this town and for baseball and how straight up and how good of a man he was.
Totally. Best game that you ever covered in Eugene, Steve, or beyond, you know, a Duck game. I know you've been there at some big moments for football and basketball, and I don't know if it'll take you a while to think and come up to it or not, but take your time. But, you know, one of the best games you ever covered was what during your time at the Guard?
You know, basketball, there was Dylan Brooks, you know, hitting a three against UCLA. That one there. Football, you know, football is different because in some of those close games, you're down on the field at the end. I mean, you know how that is, that you get the chance to be on the field. So I can't even, you know, the games run together somewhat. But there was a game, and sometimes, you know, when you're down on the field and there's, well, I guess it would have been the Oregon-Washington game 2 years ago when Verdell ran it in, because I'm right down there in that end zone as uh-huh. this is going on. And, you know, you can hear fans at that point. I don't know how you're a college football ref. I mean, the fans are just, you know, at that point, it's just drunk front row fans, and they're just F-bombing this and F-bombing that. And I couldn't imagine being a player and hearing that. You know, we're down there for the final 5 minutes of the game, we get to hear it. But I would say probably that one, just because you're right down, you know, anytime you get to be on the sideline, I mean, you're closer than anybody else. And you know what's kind of the event here, that, you know, Oregon's kind of right down there close. So I would say the Verdell one, but there's probably three or four other, just any time. I mean, the best events for me were, you know, a football game when you're down there with, when you're allowed down there with 5 minutes left and it's a 3-point game or it's a tie game. And, you know, I'm going to be down here when the major play. I remember Oregon-Stanford. It was, I think it was the championship or the year that after that Oregon went to the playoff, and there was the Oregon scored in overtime and then Stanford didn't. And so Oregon beat Stanford down there. It might actually have been Mariota's junior year. But anyway, I just remember games when you're on the field and you're so close to them. And those are the ones that I'll never forget, is being able to have that ticket for those last 5 minutes when it's a close game and you're looking at the clock going, I hope this thing's still tied, or I hope it's a 3-point game when I get down there, when they let us go down there with 5 minutes left, because this would be unbelievable to be this close to the action as whenever the final score happens.
Yeah, that UCLA game was wild. Awesome shot by Dylan Brooks, and the Washington games for football, those just had a different level of hype, and I can only imagine being there in the end zone for that Verdell run. Steve, we're going to wrap up here with a couple more questions. Again, really appreciate your time. One of the ones that I definitely wanted to ask you is, as we all know, being on Twitter is a large part of a sports reporter, sports media job, and Preston and I, we always joke about some of the stuff that you see on Twitter as you know, really kind of a wild app in some respects, especially in the sports Twitter. But if you could maybe detail a couple of the most memorable Twitter interactions that you've had over the years, whether that's with a fan responding to one of your articles or someone just saying something completely outrageous. Do you have a couple off top that you'll always look back to and think to yourself, I just can't believe that this app is free?
The first one that comes to mind was, there was something, this is probably right after Oregon, but it's probably 2012, and I think Oregon State had beaten Oregon, and I had tweeted something out, and an Oregon State baseball fan like came at me with something really accusatory, and I was like, you know, and my tweet was like, tough guy on Twitter, and then he responded, and he was like, literally, like, put his address out there and was like, come on over, I'll show you how tough of a guy I am. And I was like, you know, tough guy on Twitter part two. And then he kept responding, and I think I went like part four. I just kept saying, you know, tough guy on Twitter part three, part four. And this guy, you know, by the end was almost, you know, seething at the mouth, if you could see that on Twitter. But like I say, he had literally put his address out there, and he had put the time he'd be home. And it was all over, just like, I think there was like some Oregon State baseball player who wasn't going to be in like the starting lineup that day. And I had said, you know, this would be a big, big deal that he's not there. It just started so minor and built up to that. So that's actually the one that kind of jumps out. There are a lot to where I got much more reserved the last couple of years. Cause I just, you know, there were times that I knew that if I, you know, there are some people at Oregon who like to joke about Mims after dark to where, you know, sometimes if you're sitting around at night, maybe you've had a drink or two, and I'd be like, you know, I just tweet something out. And then it was like, all right, I got to stop it there, cause I'm not going to get into something with people. And, but there are also times, even, you know, just during the workday, where it's like, this is something I feel like I should tweet, but I know I'm going to get 35 people and I'm going to end up in a back and forth. And sometimes it would be like, you know, I'm volunteering at my kid's school today from like 11 to 1. I don't want to like respond to somebody on Twitter at 10:30 and come out at 1 o'clock and look and realize that I have like 40 people who are like jumping and angry and wondering why I haven't responded to their thing. So that was one thing that was interesting, was as my kids were getting to school age and I'd be doing something with them, I would alter kind of my social media stuff to make sure that I wasn't tweeting something like before I was taking him to school or before, just something where you knew there was going to be an hour and a half or a 2 hour window before you're going to be seeing it, because you never know. And if somebody comes at you, you know, and you don't respond right away, then other people are like, you know, well, Mims is kind of really shut down on this. He's not standing on that. And it could be like, I was sitting like kind of reading to, you know, a second grade class for the last 45 minutes, but nobody wants to see that, you know, afterwards. So a lot of it I had to kind of start to build around my family. If I was going to say something, you know, that I knew was going to get some reaction, and I was never the hot take guy. That was never my thing. I hope that my reputation was always as more kind of the grinder, the guy that was kind of dealing with facts and covering games and this and that. But there were times in social media where I would think there was something to say, but I knew, whether, like I say, whether it was a kid's school or it was just something I was going to be doing something for the next hour, I didn't, you know, I would think about, do I want to do this? And then suddenly find out that people are going crazy when I come back on in an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's tough, man. Like even myself who definitely didn't have the following that you did on social media, like wanting to speak my mind about topics outside of sports, it's dicey, man. It's something you got to think about. I know Greif told us the same thing. You know, when we talked to him, he's a guy who's similar to you in the sense of does a great job of sticking to the nuts and bolts and isn't known as the hot take guy, which is awesome. Those are the kind of guys that we respect the most, for sure. Last question from me before, I think Big Tony might have one more and then we'll wrap up. And again, Steve Vimps, formerly of the Register Guard, joining us. Favorite industry moment, Steve, or one favorite industry moment. And what we mean by that here on Tony in the Field isn't like favorite game you covered. What we mean is like funniest, like media industry moment, whether that's a funny question or a coach ranting or a coach responding to a funny question. Sky brought up a great one when we had him on last year. So, you know, someone at an Oregon basketball media scrum was asking Dane Altman how he should implement a zone defense to his son's like youth basketball team, for example. And Altman was a little thrown off by that. So do you have any kind of like funny question that you remember someone asking that stands out, or a funny coach moment or a funny coach answer during all your time in all those media scrums over the years?
There were so many of those that would, you know, I'm going to sound old and curmudgeon-y, but you know, so many times, you know, when you're like, oh, here's somebody who's coming over, you know, somebody who's been, you know, an important part of the game, or, you know, a Troy Dye or something, say, you know, he's coming over and let's talk. And then like the first person would be like, you know, Troy, video games, who's the best, you know, at playing 2K on the team? And you're like, all right, well, I want to ask him about, you know, kind of something, this and that. And then like the other person would do like three of those. And then he's kind of smiling, and Troy'd be, you know, such a fun loving guy. And it's like, well, now if I got to jump in and ask him, you know, why'd you guys miss this play on, you know, this one in this last game? Or, you know, when you'd end up, and that's, again, gets back to what I was kind of ranting on earlier about, you know, in terms of having like everything being media scrums, you know, you'll have somebody from one thing that comes in with, you know, or I'm going to ask you, you know, what's your favorite, you know, Troy, what's your, you know, or traditionally, and I want to rip on your former TV brethren, but traditionally, you know, leading into the Thanksgiving game, you're like trying to ask, and somebody on TV would say, you know, well, what's your, do you like, you know, do you want ham for your Thanksgiving, or are you looking more for the mashed potatoes and the gravy? What's your favorite mashed potatoes and gravy? This thing? I remember this with like Marcus Arroyo, and it's like, God, I get like three questions I want to ask him that are not going to be softball, you know, and like the first person that jumps in there is asking him what his Thanksgiving traditions are. So now I got to take him from this to that. So that would always bug me in like the, in the group ones to start out with, you know, somebody's in there asking him about, you know, what he does on Thanksgiving, for whether or not he's a cranberry on his turkey or not type person. And then I'm coming and saying, well, you know, when you guys were in the game last week and it's 3rd and 8 and you guys are running the ball, why are you doing that? It makes it a more difficult transition, certainly.
Yeah, that I think that is, you talked about that earlier, just in terms of like limited access to one-on-ones and then everything being in groups. And if they are in groups like they were, then it's tougher to ask some of those questions because inevitably there will be a shift in the dialogue. And that's a really funny example, though, in terms of games and the mashed potatoes and gravy.
Here's one that comes to my mind. I always remember this because, and I love both these guys who are involved in this, but when Mariota, it was after the Stanford game that they had lost and that he had clearly been injured. And Jason Quick, again, who's one of my best friends and was at the Oregon at the time, was asking him, you know, so how serious is the injury? And if you know Mariota was like, no, I'm okay. And he was trying to kind of dig into more, you know, what's going on with this? And, you know, what's it been diagnosed as? And Marcus is like, you know, I'm not really going to that and this and that. So Jason asked like kind of three probing questions and gets nothing. And like the second that Marcus is done with that one, Jerry Allen jumps in and he's like, Marcus, it looks like, are you trying to grow a mustache? It's like, yeah, Jerry's watching this and realizing, all right, Marcus didn't want to answer my question, so I'm going to completely turn this thing. And so it goes from, you know, Marcus, how's your MCL? Marcus, you're going to play this week. Marcus, were you compromised on Saturday? To Marcus, it looks like you're trying to grow a mustache. And so that was, again, sometimes you get with, you know, people with different agenda. You know, Jerry's trying to do his Duck Insider show and Jason's trying to do the Oregonian, and, you know, some TV person might be trying to do kind of an off color thing. And then the newspaper, you know, you just get kind of, that's kind of the frustrating, you know, like I say, back in the old days, it would be, you know, people kind of come in and get them one-on-one, but when you've got literally 15 people there who might have 12 different story ideas. And then if you want to follow up on one or two, then you're taking somebody else's time. It just becomes a different world and becomes a lot more difficult to tell the stories you want to tell.
Absolutely. Steve, I got the honor of asking the last question here, so I'm going to make it a good one. And then Preston, I'm sure he has some closing comments, but here we go. What advice would you give an up and coming sports writer / reporter that wants to work in this industry?
Find a new industry. You know, and I say that, you know, from personal experience. I just found a new industry. Sometimes I get concerned when I see, you know, 30-year-old people who have kind of made it big and have made it to, say, The Athletic, and then, you know, The Athletic had layoffs, and I see those people who are like, hey, my DMs are open for journalism jobs, this and that, and I just think, you know, I just think at 25, at 30, I think this would be a really difficult job to try to look. I mean, I'm 49 years old, and I looked at it a year ago and thought, I don't think I can get to retirement in this job, in this business. I didn't want to move. My family's from here. My wife went to high school at Sheldon. My two kids are from here. You know, my two kids grew up here. And so I'm not moving. So, but even like it used to be in the old days in the newspaper business, you know, if you were really good at what you did, you know, you were at the, you know, Register Guard, you moved up to another place. Or if you were at, you know, the Medford paper, you moved on to a bigger paper. But now it just feels more and more that even the bigger papers have come under kind of these corporate ownership, and most of the jobs that they're offering are entry level at this point. There's not a whole lot of newspapers, and I'm only going to speak to newspapers. I don't know, you know, TV. I don't know The Athletic websites like that. I'll just speak to newspapers that, you know, for the most part, if they're hiring now, they want to hire somebody young who wants to come in and you know, take a lower salary to kind of do the job that they've always dreamed of doing. There's a lot of people who want to be sports reporters. There's a lot of people who want to talk to the football coach and talk to the football players. And it's just a tough business right now because there's so many people doing it that people can hire labor that's less expensive. They're not now going out and trying to find the quality people that they saw, you know, say somebody at, you know, a smaller paper can move up to a bigger one. Nowadays, even the bigger ones are hiring people who are younger because they're less expensive. So I think this business is moving to, and even The Athletic, you know, I mean, The Athletic took so many newspaper reporters from other places, and it was sort of like, wow, this is kind of the one place that's really investing in it. And then 4 months ago, they laid off a bunch of people. And so it was like, wow, even there, they can lay people off. So I just think, you know, I wish people luck. And look, when I came out of college, this is what I wanted to do, was be a sports writer. And I did it for 25 years and enjoyed most of them. And I wouldn't tell anybody, hey, if that's what you want to do, don't. But I would tell you that your expectations probably shouldn't be real high. I mean, the idea is these days that you're going to start out in the business at a young age and build up and, you know, move your way up the ladder. It's a lot harder these days. And I was a guy who did the ultra. I started out at a weekly paper in Lincoln City. I moved to a daily paper in Grants Pass. I went part-time at the Oregonian before I went to the Register Guard. I felt like I was almost like a minor league baseball player, going single-A, double-A, triple-A and up. A lot of people also now coming out of college don't want to do, they don't want to go work at the small weekly paper. You know, they, in college, when they were at the college paper, they were covering college sports. They don't want to go to the, you know, the Lincoln City, the Newport paper and cover high school sports for a weekly paper. That's not what kind of they were trained to do in college, and they don't want to do that. And that's fine. But, you know, there was, you know, formerly a way to move up. It's not as much there now. Even people now who are at those papers, I feel bad for, because if you're the sports editor of the Grants Pass paper, in the old days, you would have thought, hey, I could get a promotion and go to the Oregonian or go to the Register Guard. Well, nowadays, the positions they're hiring for are more entry level or lower salary, and you're probably were making more as the sports editor at the smaller papers. So it's a tough business. You know, I guess I'd tell people, vary your skills, make sure, you know, you can do a lot of different things. But it would be a hard bit, you know, my kids in seventh grade, I'd have a hard time telling him, let's go into sports writing. Whereas when I was in seventh grade and told my dad that's what I wanted to do, he was like, that's awesome. That would be a great job for you. And my dad loved the fact that I was a sports writer and I loved it. And, you know, up until the last couple of years, it was really, even if it wasn't the most profitable job in the world for me, it was a job that I really felt like I was valued where I was, and I really enjoyed what I did. But I just think this is a business that's hard to find spots where that's still the case. And so it's becoming more needle in a haystack than it was. Certainly it used to be that you could be at the, I mean, you could even be at the Roseburg News Review for a career, and that could be a career. But nowadays it's really, there's more people that want to do it than there are jobs. And a lot of the people like me who are doing it leave. And then when people leave, they tend to be replaced by younger people, because corporations aren't, you know, it's no longer being hired in-house. When I was hired, it was John Conrad, the sports editor, was the guy who made that decision and hired me. And there's no longer a sports editor at the Register Guard. There's no longer a sports columnist at the Register Guard. The person who would be hiring a sports reporter would be a news person. So the hiring process is a lot different, and I think it would be a lot more difficult, I would guess, heading into this. So my thing would be, hey, if you love sports, enjoy it and be a fan. But, man, I'd look around and see if there are other things you can do, because I think this is going to be a tough business newspaper-wise to break into.
Well, Steve, couple decades of just awesome work from you. Thanks for, on behalf of all of us media members and non-media members, for all your great work over the years. And yeah, man, it's just really awesome to read your work. And hey, now that you have weekends off, you can, you know, lower that golf score and hang out with your kids a little more often on the weekends.
Sounds good, man. Is this the point where I get to plug myself?
Plug yourself if you want. Yes, sir. Big Tony, yeah, and I have kids or a wife yet, for as far as the life insurance stuff, but maybe one day. But we do have listeners.
No, anybody who does, like I say, it's. I'd love to chat with people. You know, I've had a lot of people on Twitter who've reached out, and it's been great to have people like that. So, you know, anybody, you know, I'd love to anybody who's got anything in the financial services they're interested in, I'd love to talk to them. Give me a call. You know, you can reach me at 541-520-9015, and My email is smims@ft.newyorklife.com. And even if you just want to talk Duck football for a little while, or if you want to talk that and then see kind of what we're doing, I'd be more than happy to chat and would love to catch up with people who've read. And I appreciate you guys having me on. It's been kind of fun to sit here and reflect. I've done a lot of that just in kind of conversations with people, but those don't normally last. I really appreciate you guys having me on this long, and you guys have asked some questions that have really made me kind of look back and smile on what I look back on was a really good 21 years, and I'm just excited for what's next. But I really enjoyed being in this market for 21 years and enjoyed the people I dealt with. So I appreciate you guys having me on and a chance to tell people what I'm doing next.
That's awesome. We definitely have a big fan base of Oregon fans and alums, so I'm sure we'll no doubt be reaching out to you if they haven't already. But yeah, thanks, Steve. And anytime you're up in Portland, let's grab a beer, man, and take it easy.
Sounds great, man. Hey, I appreciate it, Preston. Thanks, Big Tony. Appreciate you guys having me on. And yeah, that was fun. It's cool to be on the other side. Back in the old day, I was always the one asking the questions. It's kind of fun to be on the side answering them. So I appreciate you guys having me on and chatting about it. I really appreciate it. And yeah, Preston, I will definitely do that. And Big Tony, I'd love to have you come out and join us too. It'd be great to, I always enjoy industry talk, even as I leave the industry. I'll always enjoy looking back on kind of what this industry and all of it was, and it'd be great to get together and chat about it.
No doubt. We'll get that beer soon. Thanks so much for everything, Steve. Great conversation.
You got it, guys.
And again, many thanks to our guy, Steve Mims, who just put in some serious work as an industry vet, a couple of decades in the industry covering Oregon sports. And I'm serious. He's a great dude. So give him a shout on the life insurance side things. If you folks who are our age and you're mid to later 20s want to start thinking about that stuff or know anyone who does, you know, he's a really good dude. So let's chat Pac-12 football. Tyler Hero, Sports Media Bite, some gambling picks and some rants here, Big Tony. You and I both read the news. The Pac-12 football has announced, the Pac-12 has announced that there will be 7 college football games starting November 6th, conference title game on December 18th. So the start day is a Friday. The Pac-12 title game, as usual, will be on a Friday this year, December 18th. A couple of notes Ralph Russo brought up on Twitter that even if the Pac-12 champion doesn't qualify for the college football playoff, the Pac-12 is still guaranteed a spot in a New Year's Six Bowl, which means $4 million. And then each Power Five conference still gets $66 million annually from the college football playoff, regardless if there's a team from that conference in there or not. I'm not going to dig too deep into the financial side, but the point is it's good that the Pac-12 is at least playing. They're eligible for a New Year's Six Bowl, so the winner will go there, much like how USC went to, I want to say, the Fiesta Bowl against Ohio State the year that no team made the playoff, and it was a Rose Bowl playoff that year. That was a couple years back with Sam Darnold, as will be the case this year since it's the Rose and Sugar as the playoff spots this season. I'm really happy to have the conference back. Obviously, it's still 6 weeks away. Starts November 6th. I know a lot of the coaches were talking about wanting to have a bit more familiarity with their players and have the players come back for like what is essentially going to be their official fall camp. And we've seen a lot of injuries in the NFL. Obviously, week 2 is just a terrible injury week in the NFL. So maybe it is good after all that the players will get 6 weeks to train up and get used to contact and all that. To avoid injury. It's obviously not ideal. My first thought was, dang, what the heck took so long? I still feel that way, but we'll take it. We'll take it better than nothing. And it's, in my opinion, it's better than 10 games in like January, February, March. That never made any sense to me. So we'll take it. I think that it's going to be basically impossible for a Pac-12 team to make it to the college football playoff, especially with no non-conference games being played and kind of little national credibility outside of obviously Oregon, who won the Rose Bowl last year. You know, say Oregon goes 7-0, but they kind of narrowly beat some teams. Are they going to get in over a couple 10-0, maybe even 9-1 teams from the SEC? It's going to be interesting. I don't know if they would, and that's what bothers me the most probably about this 7-game schedule, is I still feel like the Pac-12 is at a competitive disadvantage by only playing 7 games and not playing 10 games with regards to being able to earn a spot in the college football playoff.
My take is it is what it is. You're taking lemons and you turn it into lemonade at this point. As a fan, I'm happy that Pac-12 football is back. As an Oregon alumni, I'm happy that Oregon football is back. I still stand by my take about how I'm not really thrilled with college football going on in the midst of a pandemic. Just, you know, thinking of it as yet another risk that these student athletes are going to have to incur with, again, no additional reward, no reward in the first place. There's little to no compensation for any of these players, but yeah, it's a bizarre once in a lifetime schedule for college football and for Pac-12 football in particular. And that 7-game schedule, I predict, is going to be just incredibly sweaty for everyone that's going to be involved. I think that there's going to be a ton of weird Pac-12 after dark Pullman on a Friday night type games, no matter where they're being played. And the conference, I think, even more so than in years past, is going to beat up on each other. College football playoff, probably not in the cards. Good that there's a guaranteed NY6 Bowl, like you said, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know really what to make of it other than it is what it is, and I guess we'll see everyone on that first week in November for some Pac-12 after dark.
Just win, baby. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Hopefully there aren't many cancellations, or obviously hopefully there aren't any cancellations. By the way, just looking at my iPhone calendar here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There will be no bye weeks as I just kind of look at my calendar right here leading up to that title game. So no room for error as far as if a team comes up with coronavirus cases, which will be pretty tough to navigate given we've seen a ton of cancellations so far in college football, but obviously rooting for a clean slate. Again, my overall takeaway is, you know, the play, and I totally get what you're saying as far as you're against college football being played during a pandemic. I will point out, and I know you know this, a lot of the college football players wanted to play. In fact, most of them, I didn't really see a strong opposition to playing. And even if they do sit out, they're all guaranteed their scholarships. In fact, many folks who originally opted out have opted back in. So there is that. But I still get your overall point. I mean, anything during a pandemic is obviously a little awkward and odd, and there's uncertainty to it. But that's kind of where I'm at there. Just hope that that the Pac-12 has a say, man. It's gonna feel kind of like the BCS in the Pac-12, where it's like if you lose one game, you're out of the national conversation, pretty much. Like obviously, a 6-1 Pac-12 champion isn't gonna get into the college football playoff this year when you consider all these other conferences are playing, 8 to 11 games with conference champions, and they all have better reputations than the Pac-12 anyway. You can't necessarily fault the Pac-12 for taking so long. If their tagline is "we're just, you know, ensuring the health and safety of the student athletes," like there's, like I'm sure they probably are. There's no way like you can argue against that. But at the same time, it's just a huge bummer that it took so long when other conferences were much swifter. That being said, I know that the Big Ten didn't have the daily testing that the Pac-12 does when they elected to get underway. I think they do now, but they didn't at the time. There's that. You want to move on to Tyler Hero here, as Hero heated up for 37 points for the Miami Heat against the Boston Celtics. That series scoring wise is actually literally tied exactly at 441 points each. I saw Zach Lowe tweet that out, but Tyler Hero with 37, and I texted me, Pierce, Matt, and John Dunn have a little group text going. I texted them last night in the early third quarter when Hero had like 18, and I was like, he is dominating this game. A 20-year-old is dominating the Eastern Conference Finals, and then he scored more than double that. He ended up dropping 37, obviously hit a ton of insane threes. He was being checked by Marcus Smart and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. I mean, these are really good young wing defenders. And he was just relentless. I mean, Big Tony, your thoughts on the overall clinic that Tyler Hero put on for the Heat?
Yeah, how old is he again? I mean, seriously, it's insane. 20 years old and he's doing this. Broke all kind of records last night. more than the scoring too, Chief. I saw a stat today that he's actually leading the Heat for this series in assists, and he's second in rebounding. And this dude is coming off the bench. Duncan Robinson starts over him. That probably will change. I'd hope that would change at this point. He's playing like 30 minutes a game now, and with how hot he is, I'm sure Spo will put him in the starting lineup eventually, but this is incredible, man. This is – I always knew that Tyler Hero was good. I didn't see this level out of him this early. But if he's doing this as a 20-year-old rookie, just imagine this dude in a couple of years. His ceiling is so high and his skill set is so broad that I think that he's going to be one of the premier star guards in the East in the next few years and then eventually the entire league. He really is just such a gifted, talented offensive player. And then on defense, he's really no slouch either. But I mean, I don't know. This guy is something special. And I think that it's going to be so much fun to watch him over the years and see how he develops and turns into a legitimate star. That's what I think he can be anyway. And one last point. How did this guy get left off the first team all rookie?
How do they put Kendrick Nunn over him? What?
They put Kendrick Nunn over him. Tyler Hero, folks, did not make first team all rookie. What's going on with the voting these days, man?
Yeah. Now that was, and I get that Nunn had like a weird, great regular season stretch, but he like literally hasn't played for the Heat in the playoffs. He's a giant ball hog. He is someone who I would not want on my team. Whereas Hero moves so well off the ball. Obviously, it helps when you're making a ton of shots, but dude, he's absolutely fearless, has insane handles. He, like, moves in a different way than pretty much anyone I've ever seen. He kind of, like, bounces around. Like, he's floats. Springy. He's like, naturally springy, and it seems like he has an insane amount of conditioning and stamina for someone who's 20. He just moves around so well, and he just, like, the way he wiggles, like he took Tatum off the dribble. Obviously, you have to respect his three, so he has a little bit easier of a time getting to the cup because folks are so guarding him so close on the perimeter. So he took Tatum off the dribble to the left last night, and he was like kind of springing to the hoop. So Tatum thought he was going to go up with the left, and he reversed it off the with the right off the glass, and there was no rim protection there for Boston. So he made the reverse layup easily, but he made Tatum look foolish, and he did it so easily. I mean, The guy is just an absolute bucket. He is one of my favorite players to watch in the league, and we've been seeing him do this in spurts throughout the year. Obviously, no one expected him to go for almost 40 in the Eastern Conference Finals, but as far as his future projection, and like we're all just enjoying him for the moment, but I agree with you. As far as his future projection, I mean, dude, at this rate, he's going to be one of the better scorers in the league for a while. And I also have to say it's not a coincidence that Tyler Hero, who was drafted in the teens, and Bam Adebayo, who was drafted in the teens, were both drafted for Miami and are having so much success at a young stage. The Heat culture is unbelievable. Eric Spoelstra is unbelievable. Pat Riley is the godfather of basketball. Him and Phil Jackson, they're the modern day godfathers. The Heat culture is unreal. The way they empower 20-year-old dudes to go out and dominate, like you can tell, like the entire team, dude, in the fourth quarter, obviously he was hot, but they've done this many times before. Like Jimmy Butler was like, dude, Tyler, take the ball, man. Or like Spo was like, hey, we're going to run screens for Hero to backdoor cut or do this or do that. Like they were running plays for Tyler Hero. There were like four possessions in the fourth quarter where it was like, yeah, Hero's pretty much just going to ISO. Maybe he'll get a screen here, but he's just going to ISO and he's just going to hit a three. And it worked. And it was just, it was unbelievable to watch, man. It was awesome. And the folks on Twitter, as you've pointed out, have loved it as well.
Oh, there was some good content last night on Twitter. Some of it not safe for work, folks. So I personally won't go into it, but if you just search on Twitter, Tyler Hero, you'll probably get a few good laughs or two. Chief, let's get on the next menu, man.
Okay, wait. I do have one quick Tyler Hero tweet that what it was appropriate. Where was it? Okay, here we go. In a non-COVID world, Tyler Herro would have hit South Beach after this game and been treated like a god during one of the wildest nights of his life. But now this man just got to go back to his room and eat a Nature Valley bar, which is deep and true. He would have hit the town on South Beach last night. Another one was Tyler Herro in his draft day fit. And folks said, pulling up to the socially distanced continental breakfast tomorrow. And it was Tyler Herro in his draft day fit. So I thought those were kind of funny. Next menu item, sports media sound bites. I don't want to give this guy too much airtime, but Jason Whitlock was sexist to Katie Nolan and Maria Taylor. He basically said, I actually didn't read the article, but I did read quotes of the article that were both tweeted out and clipped into other articles. So I didn't give Whitlock the click, but I still found out what happened, which is mission accomplished. Essentially, he was saying, you know, Katie Nolan and Maria Taylor got their jobs for, in large part, for their looks. And anyways, it's just, you know, another low blow. Honestly, nothing new from Whitlock. As this is a guy on the Fox Sports side of things who we know has just kind of sold out, in addition to the Herd and Nick Wright. So it's really nothing new and nothing surprising, but it was a bummer to see. I don't know if you have a comment on that story or not.
And Max Kellerman, that's another all-time sellout. A lot of sellouts in the industry. You hate to see it. I don't have a comment on it. It is what it is. It's Whitlock. Like, just like Steve Mims said in our interview, he knows what he's doing when he sends that stuff out. He knows the negative kind of reaction that it's going to get, but it's going to get reactions. That's the point. It's not about positive or negative when it comes down to the bottom line, which is, in his case, is he's writing for OutKick now, Clay Travis's site. Comes down to ad revenue and engagements. And so he's getting all of that digital currency through any way that, you know, by any means necessary. And his shtick is to write slandering negative pieces about people. And yeah, he did it again. Sucks. It really does. Katie Nolan, by the way, and Maria Taylor, both incredibly talented and really good at their jobs. I've admired their work over the years. So obviously it's discouraging to see stuff like that. But again, consider the source, folks.
Yeah, Katie Nolan's funny. She's just kind of got that personable Boston sports bar vibe, which I know is her background. And yeah, she's funny. And I've seen her on Highly Questionable and on Libertard's radio show as well. Maria Taylor, obviously, really rising through the ranks. Thought she did an unbelievable job with the NBA draft coverage. And she obviously does countdown now and College Game Day stuff. But I thought, you know, she's good at it.
She's really good on TV.
Really good at all of it, but I thought she was especially good on the NBA draft stuff. Just really, you know, just bonded with those players who were getting drafted that night super well. It was really good content. Big Tony, what else do you got for our sports media moments?
Another Scott slander piece by John Canzano, blasting Larry Scott yet again, this time for... I mean, this is pretty terrible, folks. Scott taking a big bonus and then laying off a bunch of people. That's the fact that was reported by John Wilner. And then Canzano wrote a column about it. But yeah, Canzano really has been sounding off on Scott. A lot of it's deserved. Again, as we said on the show, Larry Scott is, by any metric measure, the worst Power Five commissioner, and he's getting paid the absolute most. So definitely ripe for criticism. People have to hold him accountable, and that's one of the jobs in the media. What do we think about the volume of these pieces by Canzano, though, Chief? The sheer volume of these Scott slander pieces.
So here's my take on the entire Larry Scott versus John Canzano situation, which is downright hysterical, by the way.
It really is.
Those two got in a boxing ring, I'd pay $200 for that pay-per-view. You actually probably couldn't put a limit on it. I mean, and that's an idea for us, by the way, Big Tony. We got to start hosting some pay-per-views. That's one of my other get-rich-quick schemes. My overall take on Scott versus Canzano is that John Canzano has a point with every article, every column, and I'm really glad that he's holding Larry Scott accountable for his failed leadership, because that's the job of the media, is to hold people accountable, especially people of important, powerful positions, such as a commissioner of a major college conference in America. So I'm really glad that Canzano is holding him accountable. Simultaneously, I think there are many times where Canzano severely exaggerates the fact or the premise of a column. For example, he wrote a column during the Pac-12 basketball tournament recently. This was, maybe a year ago. And it said, you know, Larry Scott rents out $5,000 a night room for the Pac-12 tournament, which is a hilarious headline, but it actually wasn't true. And then Canzano, in that column, I guess to his credit, admitted that it wasn't true. The room that Scott was staying in Las Vegas, which was valued at an incredibly high price per night, was part of a package that the Pac-12 network and ESPN had negotiated for the Pac-12 tournament to be in Las Vegas. I won't bore you folks with how media negotiations work, but essentially perks like that are part of the negotiating table when those negotiation happens among executives from conferences and from media outlets and from, you know, sites such as Las Vegas. And I believe it was the MGM in particular. So anyways, I could talk for ad nauseum about this topic. In general, I think Canzano's doing a great job of holding him accountable. I also think he severely exaggerates some of the stuff, but I'm here for it. In general, I'm here for the slander. I think it's pretty funny at this point.
Bottom line, folks, we are here for Canzano versus Larry Scott. And if any of you want to weigh in on that topic, please, by all means, at Tony in the Field on Twitter, at Tony in the Field on Instagram, and make sure you smash that subscribe button on all podcast platforms. One last sports media thing I want to talk about, Chief, is this soundbite from LeBron on the media watching basketball, but are they really watching it? And let's listen in here.
Second team all rookie. You know, and then I looked at the most improved this year, and rightfully so, Brandon Ingram was amazing. I thought he should have won it. But did you see the votes that Devontae Graham get? He averaged 4 points last year compared to 17 and a half. That's not improving. What is? And it's just a weird thing sometimes that you just, I don't know how much we are really watching the game of basketball, or are we just in the narration mode, the narrative.
Folks, this is the face of the league, the face of the NBA. This isn't Shannon Sharp or Skip Bayless waking up at 6 a.m. to do Undisputed with this take. This is LeBron James talking about something very important that probably a lot of people don't know about or haven't really, they haven't really woken up and smelled this coffee yet. Just some of these votes for All NBA, Most Improved Player, Rookie of the Year from the media. And folks, this isn't like a social media award. These have financial implications to players' contracts. These are big deals. These awards matter. They really do. You have to wonder sometimes with some of these votes, like, for example, Maria Taylor leaving Anthony Davis off first team All-NBA. Like, what are we doing there? If it's a mistake, it's one thing, okay? But then also, like, some of these people that genuinely are voting volume votes for Brandon Ingram, who had a great season, but Devontae Graham, like LeBron said, going from 4 points a game to 17, 18, are we really watching basketball? Or as like you said, are we just kind of getting caught up in the narrative, watching a few games here and there, only watching national TV? If this is your job, if you have this responsibility of this privilege, really, honor and privilege of having one of those votes for All NBA, Most Improved Player, MVP, etc., by all means, you got to take this seriously, and you really have to understand the game and really know what's going on, as opposed to just watching a couple national TV games and scrolling through Twitter every night. It's a fantastic point by LeBron, and I think one that really needs to be heard from everyone in basketball.
Yeah, it's a good point to bring up. I think LeBron is pretty frustrated with the MVP voting and Giannis winning MVP again and then getting bounced in five games in the second round of the East. it's just it's a tough look when a guy wins back to back MVPs, and I love Giannis. I think he's a great player. You could argue that he had statistically the best regular season out of anyone. I admit that LeBron oftentimes will coast in the regular season, at times, not all the time, but at times he'll coast because he's 35 and he wants to, you know, essentially gather up and store energy for what he's doing right now, which is blowing teams out 4-1, 4-1, and we'll see what happens with the rest of this Nuggets series. By the way, the Maria Taylor thing, I actually looked into that, and it's a good point to bring up. She left AD off her first, second, and third All-NBA teams, but then tweeted, quote, "Wow, it's been a long week. If everyone would like to take away my voter privileges because of a clear mistake, please feel free," which I think is essentially her saying, "My bad. It was a total blunder and mistake." She didn't leave him off on purpose. But I get where you're going with Big Tony, and I think it does bring up the broader picture of the NBA MVP votes. I'm not like in any way shocked that Giannis won the MVP. I wouldn't have voted for him. I would have voted for LeBron. But I do think that he's annoyed with that. I think he is legitimately annoyed with, you know, Devontae Graham not getting more votes. But like, let's be honest, is he losing sleep over Devontae Graham not getting more most improved second place votes? Probably not. I think what he's really getting at is the system in general and the fact that he only got 16 first place votes. And he can't come out and say, "I can't believe I only got 16 first place votes," and go on like a crazy rant about it, because he doesn't want to take the focus and the mental energy off of the playoff run that him and the Lakers are on right now. But you know he feels it deep down. I mean, it's pretty obvious. And why wouldn't you? Like, you can't blame him if he's more or less the best player in the world for like a decade straight and he hasn't won an MVP. And I think it's 4 years, at least 4 or 5 years, that that it'll bug him. And I've never been like a giant MVP means you're the best player in the world kind of guy. Like, I think it's pretty obvious with Russ. And then, as much as I love him, Harden, that, you know, that doesn't mean you're the best player in the world. But I think he just liked to win it. I think that's kind of what he's getting at. But that's a good point to bring up. You got anything else to finish off that?
I think we're good. I think we move into this last stretch here. I got a couple of good rants, and you got some picks, some stone cold Lockajuias for the weekend. So let's go ahead and dive in.
Love it. All right. So I'm going to throw down my college football picks. Admittedly, it's pretty tough to get a feel for anything in college football right now. Quite frankly, it hasn't even really felt like college football season yet. This will be the first weekend where it really feels like college football season, because the SEC is back, folks. We got Florida at Ole Miss, the Grove. South Carolina is going to have 25,000 folks in the stadium. LSU is going to have as many as they can fit in there in the stadium. They got Mississippi State on CBS this weekend. Lane Kiffin, unfortunately, it looks like he's gained about 80 pounds. I don't know if you've watched any of his pressers.
Jesus, I
watched
a couple of his
pressers this
Lane.
Week.
Well, is Lane just shoveling bear claws down by the box? What's going on over there?
He has moved to the South.
Can we get Lane Kiffin a Peloton down there in Mississippi? I mean, come on, man.
All in on the barbecue and liquor scene. It might be all alcohol weight. Who knows? All beer weight. I can't wait for every college football game this weekend. Folks, I got some strong picks for you. If you're into the business of making money off of sports, I got some advice. And this is deep researched advice, plus you know, your boy thinks highly of himself when it comes to college football knowledge, because that's my favorite sport. So here we go. I got Miami minus 11 versus FSU. This game's at Miami. No Mike Norvell. He's been out with COVID. That's Florida State's new football coach, by the way. He's been out with COVID for the last 10 days. He won't be coaching in this game. They have a random interim head coach for this game. Florida State is coming off a 16-13 loss to Georgia Tech. I don't know if you folks saw, but Georgia Tech just lost at home by 4 touchdowns to Central Florida. By the way, Central Florida is a really good team with a really good offense. They basically run the old Oregon offense. Dylan Gabriel's their quarterback, lefty, sophomore, amazing, amazing player. But still, FSU not looking good. James Blackman, their quarterback, had like five turnovers in their last game. Couple of fumbles, couple of picks, turned it over on downs a couple of times. De'Eriq King, meanwhile, for Miami, he's the truth. Rhett Lashley from Auburn is their OC. He's the truth. I like Miami easily by more than 11 points. Tennessee versus South Carolina. Tennessee is on the road, 3.5-point favorite here. Tennessee was absolutely atrocious to start the year last year. I think they were like 1-6, 1-5 to start. Folks were already calling for Jeremy Pruitt's head. Folks, Jeremy Pruitt just got a 2-year contract extension this week because that's how confident they're feeling about him up there on Rocky Top. South Carolina 4-8 last year. They lost by 20 to Tennessee. Tennessee's got their quarterback, Jarrett Garantano, back. He's a little iffy, but at least he's a really good athlete and he's got experience. South Carolina's going to be starting a Colorado State transfer at quarterback. I like Tennessee easily. They finished the year, by the way, with 8 wins last year. Granted, they didn't really beat anyone super impressive, but they beat Missouri and Kentucky and Indiana in the bowl game and some okay teams to finish with 8 wins last year. I definitely like Tennessee by more than 3.5 points. Kansas versus Baylor, under 62. Kansas lost to Coastal Carolina. They only had 3 points in the first half. That was a home game to Coastal Carolina. Baylor, new coach Dave Aranda, defensive guy. They were already a very defensive team last year under Matt Rhule. Their O-line was basically all out with COVID, contract tracing, etc. They've missed a bunch of games. This will be their first game of the season. Give me the under. UCF, ECU under. Central Florida, obviously a super high-scoring team, but just the under is 77. It's just a massive number, so I'm taking the under. And then BYU minus 14 versus Troy. BYU beat Navy 55-3 in the start to season. They did have a bunch of COVID cases, but apparently everyone's healthy for this game. Their starting QB, Zach Wilson's healthy. Folks are talking about how Troy beat a team 47-14 last week. I think it was Middle Tennessee. And that's a good win. Troy actually is a really good Sun Belt program, but I looked into Middle Tennessee. They have lost both their games by a ton of points, so it seems like they suck. It's a night game in Provo. Long way for Troy to travel from the deep south. Give me BYU minus 14. Those are my locks of the week for college football. Big Tony.
I like it. And where are you going to hammer these locks? I know that the Oregon sports betting app does not have college sports yet. And I know a lot of folks that listen probably know that. So are you going to go to that casino in Oregon that does have the capability to bet on college sports? Or are you going to do it through another site? What's your strategy there?
It's a great question. I'm thinking I need to drive to Spirit Mountain tomorrow because Bovada has always sketched me out. And my bookie, Alfredo Martinez, our boy, is now no longer affiliated with Bovada. I'm going to try to get him to get back on Bovada because it's just a lot easier than driving an hour and 20 minutes to a casino. But we'll see what happens there because, yeah, like you said, unfortunately, the Oregon Scoreboard app does not let you bet on college sports. And, man, the sports gambling industry is about to explode. It's in its infancy stages right now in America. It is going to explode over the next 5 or 10 years. If there was a stock for, I guess there is DraftKings stock, you know, more or less, if there was a stock for betting, I'm buying that thing because college sports betting is about to explode. But yeah, we'll see if I end up making the drive to Spirit Mountain. It's a little out of the way, but that's the closest place that I can go. It's about an hour and a half south.
That stock is DraftKings, folks. Hammer DraftKings if you haven't already. That thing is going to the moon. All right, good picks, though. I like it. Anything on your end for the closing rants? I got one, but I'll give you the floor first, and then I can take it home.
No closing rants. I was just going to give a shout-out to our guy, Justin Herbert. Known that dude since his junior year of high school. Interviewed him plenty of times. And, shout-out to Herbert for balling out against the Chiefs. Didn't quite get the win, so can't give him the full unbelievable next Peyton Manning type props. But for finding out you're about to start at the coin toss and then going out there and throwing for 300 yards. And by the way, giving your team a chance to win, they were up a field goal with 2.5 minutes left and the defense couldn't hold off Mahomes, which can't blame them. But shout out to Herbert and pumped to see him against Carolina this weekend.
No doubt. Go Ducks. I know some folks were happier than others about Herbert's start last weekend, but go Ducks. All right. My closing rant here, Chief, about sports media. We talked about it with Steve Mims. Some of these hot take artists, a lot of this hot take content. It's just a lot of garbage. And I think my guy, Stan Verrett, I know he's your guy too, legendary SportsCenter LA anchor. The guy, him and Neil are two of the best in the biz and a great team. He's on Twitter with this one, and I'll completely quote what he says here because I think there's a lot of really good, just a really good message here, and he words it really well. So Stan Verrett on Twitter, quote, "I haven't been commenting on some of the people taking cheap shots at colleagues. They do it for attention, and smart and decent people know it. The trash people in our industry identify themselves. Just one tip. Don't ever click on their garbage. Starve them. Even if you really want to read some of it, just to verify yourself that they are indeed sad, desperate people with nonsensical takes and needless personal attacks. Don't ever click on it. You already can predict what's there." So I have no doubt that this is referring to Jason Whitlock. And it's such a good point. It's one that we always make. It's really well worded from Stan. And from here, in theory, that sounds great, right? But it hasn't been working. Like, people have been constantly talking about avoiding this stuff, but it doesn't get avoided. There's just enough of it out there where it does get attention. It's why Undisputed, First Take, it's why all these shows exist. And it's why those like Skip Bayless and Nick Wright and Steven, it's why they get paid so much, is because it is consumed at such a high volume, at such a high level. So in theory, this is great stuff from Stan. But it doesn't work. And we always talk about this on the show. We need to clean up the industry. We need to save the industry. We need to hold people in the industry accountable for some of these nonsensical personal attacks and just absolutely garbage takes. But how do we do that? Because it's clearly not working just to don't ever click on it. There's enough people that do click on it. There's enough people that do engage with it. I don't know how, but there's enough people that watch it on TV. What do we do, Chief? Because this sums up the problem in two tweets, but the answer, the solution, is much more complicated.
No, that's a good question, and one that we will continue to discuss on this pod because I know folks love it and we love it. My answer is a two-parter. Number one is just try your absolute best to not give these folks attention. I don't remember the last time I watched Undisputed or First Take on TV. I have only seen like clips that someone will retweet on Twitter. I would just say don't let it bother you, don't watch them. And we can continue to hold them accountable when necessary. I think Scott Van Pelt did a brilliant job of just owning Skip Bayless without saying his name during his Dak Prescott one big thing a couple weeks ago, when Skip just disgustingly criticized Dak for coming out about mental health issues. And, so essentially taking care of it like that. I think Van Pelt did another good job. Then as far as those of us who are still in the industry and pursuing, industry greatness, if you will, is I think we got to keep going with our pod and just keep delivering facts. I'm a big facts guy, and I know you are too. Just keep delivering the facts, man, and keep it entertaining and light and deliver the facts and have fun, lighthearted interviews and just create that fun, lighthearted culture. That's what people want. People don't want to hear about politics. They don't want to hear hot takes. They just want that fun, lighthearted culture. And that's, the other thing about the industry is I love play-by-play, and that's something I'm seriously continuing to pursue because there's no hot taking to it. It's just you got to do your homework. You got to study, and then you go out there and you perform and you try to add context in an entertaining way to a game. So I think shout out to all the play-by-play guys out there who I really respect, and shout out to the hosts, Neil Everett, Scott Van Pelt, Rosillos, etc., who keep it pretty much fact-based. And that's the approach that I'm going to continue to take.
It's well said. Let's continue to do that.
Let's do it. All right. Gas station barbecue in Kansas City? ?
That's it. That's the last thing of the show, folks. I saw our guy, John Canzano, the one, the only, him versus Larry Scott, folks. We'll have that pay-per-view one of these days. Canzano tweeted out a photo of this unbelievable barbecue platter from a gas station in Kansas City. I think one of his friends had sent him that. But it got me thinking, where the hell are these on the West Coast? I mean, it really does just mean more over there, right? Like KC barbecue, you always hear about it. But at a gas station? The best thing that you could get at a California gas station or an Oregon gas station is a can of Red Bull. Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's like the only thing that you could probably trust. Maybe a bag of Doritos, but you're not getting barbecue from any gas stations on the West Coast. Hell, you're not getting any food that'll give you food poisoning unless it's packaged. I mean, come on, man. I saw that and I was like, damn, we got to step it up over here. I get that gas stations are, you know, they can't all be as great as that, but can we at least get a little bit of a better spread out here on the West Coast?
You know what that reminded me of was when we got that gas station chicken in New Orleans. That chicken probably top,
it was fire.
Top five fried chicken I've ever had. And it was at a convenience store in New Orleans.
Brothers Chicken.
I think it's just the culture, man. I think food just means a lot more down there, particularly fried/unhealthy food. But food just kind of means more down there. And those folks are... The thing is, it was high quality. I mean, that fried chicken was like high quality, great fried chicken. And I think that's all there is to it, man. The food's the big culture down there. On the West Coast, at least I can speak for Oregon and Southern California. You know, the food culture is fresh seafood at nice restaurants and wine and coffee, which is also great in its own right. It's just different. But yeah.
And $10 avocado toast. Come on, folks. Let's get a couple of burnt end sandwiches going at some of these gas stations. God, I'd be down for that.
Oh, that sounds good. We got to make it out to the South again, man. We'll make it out to Kansas City or a Bama game or something. Oh man! All right, Big Tony, is that a wrap for us?
We're good to go, folks. Really appreciate you guys listening to Tony in the Field as always.
Shout out to Steve Mims for coming on. Great interview with him. He's a legendary sports writer in the Oregon sports writing scene, particularly in Eugene. Again, he spent over two decades grinding for the Register Guard. So big hat tip to him as he phases out of the media game and phases into a new point in his career. And yeah, good pod, Big Tony. Really good pod. One of the best interviews we've done in quite some time, just breaking down the industry. And then we had our gambling picks and our quick topics there as well. So, folks, thanks for listening. Again, Tony in the Field on Twitter and Instagram. I just gave us a shout-out on my personal IG page. And then Tony in the Field on SoundCloud, on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your podcasts. You know where to find us, Tony in the Field. Thanks for listening, and we will see you guys next week.